the exploit of the lad Phaeton, described in a famous tale from the Greeks. Born of a virgin in Ethiopia and taunted by his playmates to search the question of his father, he set off across Persia and India to find the palace of the sun. For his mother had told him that his father was Phoebus, the god who drove the solar chariot. The palace of the sun stood high on lofty columns, bright with glittering gold and bronze that shone like fire. Gleaming ivory crowned the gables above. The double folding doors were radiant with burnished silver. And the workmanship was more beautiful than the materials. Climbing the steep path, Phaeton arrived beneath the roof, and he discovered Phoebus sitting on an emerald throne, surrounded by the hours and the seasons, and by day, month, year, and century. The bold youngster had to halt at the threshold, his mortal eyes unable to bear the light, but the father gently spoke to him across the hall. "Why have you come?" the father asked. "What do you seek, O Phaeton? A son no father need deny." The lad respectfully replied, "O my father, if thou grantest me the right to use that name, Phoebus, light of the entire world, grant me a proof, my father, by which all may know me for thy true son." The great god set his glittering crown aside and bade the boy approach. He gathered him into his arms. Then he promised, sealing the promise with a binding oath, that any proof the lad desired would be granted. What Phaeton desired was his father's chariot and the right to drive the winged horses for a day. "Such a request," said the father, "proves my promise to have been rashly made." He put the boy a little away from him and sought to dissuade him from the demand. "In your ignorance," said he, "you are asking for more than can be granted even to the gods. Each of the gods may do as he will, and yet none, save myself, has the power to take his place in my chariot of fire. No, not even Zeus." Phoebus reasoned. Phaeton was adamant. Unable to retract the oath, the father delayed as long as time would allow, but was finally forced to conduct his stubborn son to the prodigious chariot, its axle of gold and the pole of gold, its wheels with golden tires and a ring of silver spokes. The yoke was set with chrysolites and jewels. The hours were already leading the four horses from their lofty stalls, breathing fire and filled with ambrosial food. They put upon them the clanking bridles. The great animals pawed at the bars. Phoebus anointed Phaeton's face with an ointment to protect it against the flames, and then placed on his head the radiant crown. The divinity advised,
"If, at least, you can obey your father's warnings, spare the lash and hold tightly to the reins. The horses go fast enough of themselves. And do not follow the straight road directly through the five zones of heaven, but turn off at the fork to the left. The tracks of my wheels you will clearly see. Furthermore, so that the sky and earth may have equal heat, be careful to go neither too high nor too low. For if you go too high, you will burn up the skies. And if you go too low, ignite the earth. In the middle is the safest path. But hurry. While I am speaking, dewy night has reached her goal on the western shore. We are summoned. Behold, the dawn is glowing. Boy, may fortune aid and conduct you better than you can guide yourself. Here, grasp the reins."
Tethys, the goddess of the sea, had dropped the bars, and the horses, with a jolt, abruptly started. Cleaving with their feet the clouds, beating the air with their wings, outrunning all the winds that were rising from the same eastern quarter. Immediately, the chariot was so light without its accustomed weight The car began to rock about like a ship tossing without ballast on the waves. The driver, panic-stricken, forgot the reins and knew nothing of the road. Wildly mounting, the team grazed the heights of the sky and startled the remotest constellations. The Great and Little Bear were scorched. The serpent lying curled about the polar stars grew warm, and with the heat grew dangerously fierce. Bootes took flight, encumbered with his plow. The scorpion struck with his tail. The chariot, having roared for some time through unknown regions of the air, knocking against the stars, next plunged down crazily to the clouds just above the ground, and the moon beheld, in amazement, her brother's horses running below her own. The clouds evaporated. The earth burst into flame. Mountains blazed, cities perished with their walls, nations were reduced to ashes. That was the time the peoples of Ethiopia became black, for the blood was drawn to the surface of their bodies by the heat. Libya became a desert. The Nile fled in terror to the ends of the earth and hid its head, and it is hidden yet. Mother Earth, shielding her scorched brow with her hand, choking with hot smoke, lifted her great voice and called upon Jove, the father of all things, to save his world. "Look around," she cried at him. "The heavens are asmoke from pole to pole. Great Jove, if the sea perish, and the land, and all the realms of the sky, then we are back again in the chaos of the beginning. Take thought for the safety of our universe. Save from the flames whatever yet remains." Jove, the Almighty Father, hastily summoned the gods to witness that unless some measure were quickly taken, all was lost. Thereupon he hurried to the zenith, took a thunderbolt in his right hand, and flung it from beside his ear. The car shattered. The horses, terrified, broke loose. Phaeton, fire raging in his hair, descended like a falling star. And the river Po received his burning frame. The naiads of that land consigned his body to a tomb, whereupon this epitaph:
"Here Phaeton lies, in Phoebus' car he fared. And though he greatly failed, more greatly dared."
This tale of indulgent parenthood illustrates the antique idea that when the roles of life are assumed by the improperly initiated, chaos supervenes. When the child outgrows the popular idol of the mother breast and turns to face the world of specialized adult action, it passes spiritually into the sphere of the father, who becomes, for his son, the sign of the future task, and for his daughter, of the future husband. Whether he knows it or not, and no matter what his position in society, the father is the initiating priest through whom the young being passes on into the larger world. And just as, formerly, the mother represented the good and evil, so now does he. But with this complication, that there is a new element of rivalry in the picture, the son against the father for the mastery of the universe, and the daughter against the mother to be the mastered world. The traditional idea of initiation combines an introduction of the candidate into the techniques, duties, and prerogatives of his vocation with a radical readjustment of his emotional relationship to the parental images. The mystagogue, father or father substitute, is to entrust the symbols of office only to a son who has been effectually purged of all inappropriate infantile cathexes, for whom the just, impersonal exercise of the powers will not be rendered impossible by unconscious, or perhaps even conscious and rationalized, motives of self-aggrandizement, personal preference, or resentment. Ideally, the invested one has been divested of his mere humanity, and is representative of an impersonal cosmic force. He is the twice-born. He has become himself the Father. And he is competent, consequentially, now to enact himself the role of the initiator, the guide, the sun-door, through whom one may pass from the infantile illusions of good and evil to an experience of the majesty of cosmic law, purged of hope and fear, and at peace in the understanding of the revelation of being. "Once I dreamed," declared a little boy, "that I was captured by cannonballs. They all began to jump and yell. I was surprised to see myself in my own parlor. There was a fire, and a kettle was over it, full of boiling water. They threw me into it, and once in a while the cook used to come over and stick a fork into me to see if I was cooked. Then he took me out and gave me to the chief, who was just going to bite me when I woke up." A civilized gentleman states,
"I dreamed that I was at table with my wife. During the course of the meal, I reached over and took our second child, a baby, and in a matter-of-fact fashion proceeded to put him into a green soup bowl, full of hot water or some hot liquid, for he came out cooked thoroughly, like chicken fricassee. I laid the viand on a breadboard at the table and cut it up with my knife. When we had eaten all of it except a small part, like a chicken gizzard, I looked up, worried, to my wife, and asked her, 'Are you sure you wanted me to do this? Did you intend to have him for supper?' She answered, with a domestic frown, 'After he was so well cooked, there was nothing else to do. I was just about to finish the last piece when I woke up.'"
This archetypal nightmare of the ogre father is made actual in the ordeals of primitive initiation. The boys of the Australian Murnjin tribe, as we have seen, are first frightened and sent running to their mothers. The great father snake is calling for their foreskins. This places the women in the role of protectresses. A prodigious horn is blown, named Yurlungur, which is supposed to be the call of the great father snake, who has emerged from his hole. When the men come for the boys, the women grab up spears and pretend not only to fight, but also to wail and cry, because the little fellows are going to be taken away and eaten. The men's triangular dancing ground is the body of the great father snake. There the boys are shown, during many nights, numerous dances symbolical of the various totem ancestors, and are taught the myths that explain the existing order of the world. Also, they are sent on a long journey to neighboring and distant clans, imitative of the mythological wanderings of the phallic ancestors. In this way, within the great father snake, as it were, they are introduced to an interesting new object world that compensates them for their loss of the mother. And the male phallus, instead of the female breast, is made the central point, axis mundi of the imagination. The culminating instruction of the long series of rites is the release of the boy's own hero penis from the protection of its foreskin, through the frightening and painful attack upon it of the circumciser.
The father, i.e. circumciser, is the one who separates the child from the mother, writes Dr. Roheim. What is cut off the boy is really the mother. The glands in the foreskin is the child in the mother. It is interesting to note the continuance to this day of the rite of circumcision in the Hebrew and Mohammedan cults, where the feminine element has been scrupulously purged from the official, strictly monotheistic mythology. "God forgiveth not the sin of joining other gods with him," we read in the Quran. The pagans, leaving Allah, call but upon female deities.
Among the Arunta, for example, The sound of the bull roarers is heard from all sides when the moment has arrived for this decisive break from the past. It is night, and in the weird light of the fire suddenly appear the circumciser and his assistant. The noise of the bull roarers is the voice of the great demon of the ceremony, and the pair of operators are its apparition. With their beards thrust into their mouths, signifying anger, their legs widely extended, and their arms stretched forward, the two men stand perfectly still, the actual operator in front, holding in his right hand the small flint knife with which the operation is to be conducted, and his assistant pressing close up behind him, so that the two bodies are in contact with each other. Then a man approaches through the firelight, balancing a shield on his head, and at the same time snapping the thumb and first finger of each hand. The bull roarers are making a tremendous din, which can be heard by the women and children in their distant camp. The man with the shield on his head goes down on one knee, just a little in front of the operator, and immediately one of the boys is lifted from the ground by a number of his uncles, who carry him feet foremost and place him on the shield, while in deep, loud tones, a chant is thundered forth by all the men. The operation is swiftly performed, the fearsome figures retire immediately from the lighted area, and the boy, in a more or less dazed condition, is attended to, and congratulated by the men to whose estate he has now just arrived. "You have done well," they say. "You did not cry out." The native Australian mythologies teach that the first initiation rites were carried out in such a way that all the young men were killed. The ritual is thus shown to be, among other things, a dramatized expression of the Oedipal aggression of the elder generation, and the circumcision a mitigated castration. But the rites provide also for the cannibal, patricidal impulse of the younger, rising group of males, and at the same time reveal the benign, self-giving aspect of the archetypal father. For during the long period of symbolical instruction, there is a time when the initiates are forced to live only on the fresh-drawn blood of the older men. We are told,
"The natives are particularly interested in the Christian communion rite, and having heard about it from missionaries, they compare it to the blood-drinking rituals of their own. In the evening, the men come and take their places according to tribal precedence, the boy lying with his head on his father's thighs. He must make no movement, or he will die. The father blindfolds him with his hands, because if the boy should witness the following proceedings, it is believed that his father and mother will both die. The wooden vessel, or a bark vessel, is placed near one of the boy's mother's brothers, who, having tied his arm lightly, pierces the upper part with a nose bone, and holds the arm over the vessel until a certain amount of blood has been taken. The man next to him pierces his arm, and so on, until the vessel is filled. It may hold 2 quarts or so. The boy takes a long draught of the blood. Should his stomach rebel, the father holds his throat to prevent his ejecting the blood, because if it happens, his father, mother, sisters, and brothers would all die. The remainder of the blood is thrown over him. From this time on, sometimes for a whole moon, the boy is allowed no other food than human blood, Yaminga, the mythical ancestor, having made this law. Sometimes the blood is dried in the vessel, and then the guardian cuts it in sections with his nose bone, and it is eaten by the boy. The 2 end sections first. The sections must be regularly divided, or the boy will die."
Frequently, the men who give their blood faint and remain in a state of coma for an hour or more because of exhaustion. "In former times," writes another observer, "this blood, drunk ceremonially by the novices, was obtained from a man who was killed for the purpose, and portions of his body were eaten." Here, comments Dr. Roheim, "we come as near to a ritual representation of the killing and eating of the primal father as we can ever get."
In one recorded case, two of the boys looked up when they were not supposed to. Then the old men went forward, each with a stone knife in hand. Stooping over the two boys, they opened veins in each. Out flowed the blood, and the other men all raised a death cry. The boys were lifeless. The old Wirinons, medicine men, dipping their stone knives in the blood, touched with them the lips of all present. The bodies of the Bura victims were cooked. Each man who had been to five Buras ate a piece of this flesh. No others were allowed to see this done.
There can be no doubt that no matter how unilluminated the stark naked Australian savages may seem to us, their symbolical ceremonials represent a survival into modern times of an incredibly old system of spiritual instruction, the far-flung evidences of which are to be found not only in all the lands and islands bordering the Indian Ocean, but also among the remains of the archaic centers of what we tend to regard as our own very special brand of civilization. Just how much the old men know, it is difficult to judge from the published accounts of our Occidental observers. But it can be seen from a comparison of the figures of Australian ritual with those familiar to us from higher cultures, that the great themes, the ageless archetypes and their operation upon the soul, remain the same.
For an astounding revelation of the survival in contemporary Melanesia, of a symbolic system essentially identical with that of the Egypto-Babylonian, Trojan-Cretan labyrinth complex of the second millennium BC, see John Layard's Stone Men of Malekula. W. F. J. Knight has discussed the evident relationship of the Malekulan journey of the soul to the underworld with the classical descent of Aeneas and the Babylonian of Gilgamesh, while W. J. Perry thought he could recognize evidences of this culture continuity running all the way from Egypt and Sumer out through the oceanic area to North America. Many scholars have pointed out the close correspondences between the details of the classical Greek and primitive Australian rites of initiation. It is still uncertain by what means, and in what eras, the mythological and cultural patterns of the various archaic civilizations may have been disseminated to the farthest corners of the earth. Yet it can be stated categorically that few, if any, of the so-called primitive cultures studied by our anthropologists represent autochthonous growths. They are, rather, local adaptations, provincial degenerations, and immensely old fossilizations of folkways that were developed in very different lands, often under much less simple circumstances and by other races.
Come, O Dithyrambus, enter this my male womb. This cry of Zeus, the thunder hurler, to the child, his son Dionysus, sounds the leitmotif of the Greek mysteries of the initiatory second birth. And bull voices roar thereto from somewhere out of the unseen fearful semblances, and from a drum an image as it were of thunder underground is borne on the air heavy with dread. The word Dithyrambos itself, as an epithet of the killed and resurrected Dionysus, was understood by the Greeks to signify him of the double door, him who had survived the awesome miracle of the second birth. And we know that the choral songs, dithyrambs, and dark, blood-reeking rites in celebration of the god associated with the renewal of vegetation, the renewal of the moon, the renewal of the sun, the renewal of the soul, and solemnized at the season of the resurrection of the year god, represent the ritual beginnings of the Attic tragedy. Throughout the ancient world, such myths and rites abounded. The deaths and resurrections of Tammuz, Adonis, Mithra, Virbius, Attis, and Osiris, and of their various animal representatives, goats and sheep, bulls, pigs, horses, fish, and birds, are known to every student of comparative religion. The popular carnival games of the Whitsuntide Louts, Green Georges, John Barleycorns, and Kostrubonkos, carrying out winter, bringing in summer, and killing of the Christmas wren, have continued the tradition in a mood of frolic into our contemporary calendar, and through the Christian Church, in the mythology of the fall and redemption, crucifixion and resurrection, the second birth of baptism, the initiatory blow on the cheek at confirmation, the symbolical eating of the flesh and drinking of the blood solemnly and sometimes effectively, we are united to those immortal images of initiatory might, through the sacramental operation of which man, since the beginning of his day on earth, has dispelled the terrors of his phenomenality, and won through to the all-transfiguring vision of immortal being. For if the blood of bulls and of goats, and the ashes of an heifer sprinkling the unclean, sanctifieth to the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? There is a folk tale told by the Basumbwa of East Africa, of a man whose dead father appeared to him, driving the cattle of death, and conducted him along a path that went into the ground, as into a vast burrow. They came to an extensive area where there were some people. The father hid the son and went off to sleep. The great chief, Death, appeared the next morning. One side of him was beautiful, but the other side was rotten. Maggots were dropping to the ground. His attendants were gathering the maggots. The attendants washed the sores, and when they had finished, Death said, "The one born today, if he goes trading, he will be robbed. The woman who conceives today, she will die with the child conceived. The man who cultivates today, his crops have perished. The one who is to go into the jungle has been eaten by the lion." Death thus pronounced the universal curse and returned to rest. But the following morning when he appeared, his attendants washed and perfumed the beautiful side, massaging it with oil. When they had finished, Death pronounced the blessing. "The one born today, may he become wealthy. May the woman who conceives today give birth to a child who will live to be old. The one born today, let him go into the market. May he strike good bargains. May he trade with the blind. The man who is to enter the jungle, may he kill game, may he discover even elephants, because today I pronounce the benediction." The father then said to the son, "If you had arrived today, many things would have come into your possession. But now it is clear that poverty has been ordained for you. Tomorrow you had better go." And the son returned to his home. The son in the underworld, lord of the dead, is the other side of the same radiant king, who rules and gives the day. For who is it that sustains you from the sky and from the earth? And who is it that brings out the living from the dead and the dead from the living? And who is it that rules and regulates all affairs? We recall the Wachaga tale of the very poor man, Kayazimba, who is transported by a crone to the zenith, where the sun rests at noon. There the great chief bestowed on him prosperity. And we recall the trickster god, Edshu, described in a tale from the other coast of Africa. Spreading strife was his greatest joy. These are differing views of the same dreadful providence. In him are contained and from him proceed the contradictions, good and evil, death and life, pain and pleasure, boons and deprivation. As the person of the sun door, he is the fountainhead of all the pairs of opposites. With him are the keys of the unseen. In the end unto him will be your return. Then will he show you the truth of all that ye did. The mystery of the apparently self-contradictory father is rendered tellingly in the figure of a great divinity of prehistoric Peru named Viracocha. His tiara is the sun. He grasps a thunderbolt in either hand, and from his eyes descend, in the form of tears, the rains that refresh the life of the valleys of the world. Viracocha is the universal god, the creator of all things, and yet, in the legends of his appearances upon the earth, he is shown wandering as a beggar, in rags and reviled. One is reminded of the Gospel of Mary and Joseph at the inn doors of Bethlehem, and of the classical story of the begging of Jove and Mercury at the home of Baucis and Philemon. One is reminded also of the unrecognized Edchu. This is a theme frequently encountered in mythology. Its sense is caught in the words of the Quran, "Whithersoever ye turn, there is the presence of Allah. Though he is hidden in all things," say the Hindus, "that soul shines not forth, yet he is seen by subtle seers with superior, subtle intellect." "Split the stick," runs a Gnostic aphorism, and there is Jesus. Viracocha, therefore, in this manner of manifesting his ubiquity, participates in the character of the highest of the universal gods. Furthermore, his synthesis of sun god and storm god is familiar. We know it through the Hebrew mythology of Yahweh, in whom the traits of two gods are united, Yahweh, a storm god, and El, a solar. It is apparent in the Navajo personification of the father of the twin warriors. It is obvious in the character of Zeus, as well as in the thunderbolt and halo of certain forms of the Buddha image. The meaning is that the grace that pours into the universe through the sun door is the same as the energy of the bolt that annihilates and is itself indestructible. The delusion-shattering light of the imperishable is the same as the light that creates. Or again, in terms of a secondary polarity of nature, the fire blazing in the sun glows also in the fertilizing storm. The energy behind the elemental pair of opposites, fire and water, is one and the same. But the most extraordinary and profoundly moving of the traits of Viracocha, this nobly conceived Peruvian rendition of the universal god, is the detail that is peculiarly his own, namely that of the tears. The living waters are the tears of God. Herewith the world-discrediting inside of the monk, "All life is sorrowful," is combined with the world-begetting affirmative of the father, "Life must be." In full awareness of the life anguish of the creatures of his hand, in full consciousness of the roaring wilderness of pains, the brain-splitting fires of the deluded, self-ravaging, lustful, angry universe of his creation, this divinity acquiesces in the deed of supplying life to life. To withhold the seminal waters would be to annihilate, yet to give them forth is to create this world that we know. For the essence of time is flux, dissolution of the momentarily existent, and the essence of life is time. In his mercy, in his love for the forms of time, this demiurgic man of men yields countenance to the sea of pangs. But in his full awareness of what he is doing, the seminal waters of the life that he gives are the tears of his eyes. The paradox of creation, the coming of the forms of time out of eternity, is the germinal secret of the Father. It can never be quite explained. Therefore, in every system of theology, there is an umbilical point, an Achilles tendon which the finger of Mother Life has touched, and where the possibility of perfect knowledge has been impaired. The problem of the hero is to pierce himself, and therewith his world, precisely through that point, to shatter and annihilate that key knot of his limited existence. The problem of the hero going to meet the Father is to open his soul beyond terror to such a degree that he will be ripe to understand how the sickening and insane tragedies of this vast and ruthless cosmos are completely validated in the majesty of being. The hero transcends life with its peculiar blind spot, and for a moment rises to a glimpse of the source. He beholds the face of the Father, understands, and the two are atoned. In the biblical story of Job, the Lord makes no attempt to justify in human or any other terms the ill pay meted out to his virtuous servant. A simple and upright man, and fearing God, and avoiding evil. Nor was it for any sins of their own that Job's servants were slain by the Chaldean troops, his sons and daughters crushed by a collapsing roof. When his friends arrive to console him, they declare, with a pious faith in God's justice, that Job must have done some evil to have deserved to be so frightfully afflicted. But the honest, courageous, horizon-searching sufferer insists that his deeds have been good, whereupon the comforter, Elihu, charges him with blasphemy, as naming himself more just than God. When the Lord himself answers Job out of the whirlwind, he makes no attempt to vindicate his work in ethical terms, but only magnifies his presence, bidding Job do likewise on earth in human emulation of the way of heaven.
Gird up thy loins now like a man. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. Wilt thou also disannul my judgment? Wilt thou condemn me, that thou mayest be righteous? Hast thou an arm like God, or canst thou thunder with a voice like him? Deck thyself now with majesty and excellency, and array thyself with glory and beauty. Cast abroad the rage of thy wrath, and behold every one that is proud, and abase him. Look on every one that is proud, and bring him low, and tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together, and bind their faces in secret. Then I will also confess unto thee that thine own hand can save thee.
There is no word of explanation, no mention of the dubious wager with Satan described in chapter 1 of the book of Job. Only a thunder and lightning demonstration of the fact of facts, namely, that man cannot measure the will of God, which derives from a center beyond the range of human categories. Categories indeed are totally shattered by the Almighty of the book of Job, and remain shattered to the last. Nevertheless, to Job himself, the revelation appears to have made soul-satisfying sense. He was a hero who, by his courage in the fiery furnace, his unreadiness to break down and grovel before a popular conception of the character of the All-Highest, had proven himself capable of facing a greater revelation than the one that satisfied his friends. We cannot interpret his words of the last chapter as those of a man merely intimidated. They are the words of one who has seen something surpassing anything that has been said by way of justification. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself, and repent in dust and ashes. The pious comforters are humbled. Job is rewarded with a fresh house, fresh servants, and fresh daughters and sons. After this lived Job 140 years, and saw his sons and his sons' sons, even 4 generations. So Job died, being old and full of days. For the son, who has grown really to know the Father, the agonies of the ordeal are readily borne. The world is no longer a veil of tears, but a bliss-yielding, perpetual manifestation of the presence. Contrast with the wrath of the angry God known to Jonathan Edwards and his flock, the following tender lyric from the miserable Eastern European ghettos of that same century.
O Lord of the universe, I will sing thee a song. Where canst thou be found, and where canst thou not be found? Where I pass, there art thou. Where I remain, there too thou art. Thou, thou, and only thou. Doth it go well? 'Tis thanks to thee. Doth it go ill? Ah, 'tis also thanks to thee. Thou art, thou hast been, and thou wilt be. Thou didst reign, thou reignest, and thou wilt reign. Thine is heaven, thine is earth. Thou fillest the high regions, and thou fillest the low regions. Wheresoever I turn, thou, O thou, art there.
5. Apotheosis. One of the most powerful and beloved of the bodhisattvas of the Mahayana Buddhism of Tibet, China, and Japan is the lotus-bearer, Avalokiteshvara, the Lord looking down in pity, so called because he regards with compassion all sentient creatures suffering the evils of existence. To him goes the million-fold repeated prayer of the prayer wheels and temple gongs of Tibet, Om Mani Padme Hum. The jewel is in the lotus. To him go perhaps more prayers per minute than to any single divinity known to man. For when, during his final life on earth as a human being, he shattered for himself the bounds of the last threshold, which moment opened to him the timelessness of the void beyond the frustrating mirage enigmas of the named and bounded cosmos, he paused. He made a vow that before entering the void, he would bring all creatures without exception to enlightenment. And since then, he has permeated the whole texture of existence with the divine grace of his assisting presence, so that the least prayer addressed to him throughout the vast spiritual empire of the Buddha is graciously heard. Under differing forms he traverses the 10,000 worlds and appears in the hour of need and prayer. He reveals himself in human form with two arms, in superhuman forms with four arms or with six or 12 or 1,000, and he holds in one of his left hands the lotus of the world. Like the Buddha himself, this godlike being is a pattern of the divine state to which the human hero attains who has gone beyond the last terrors of ignorance. When the envelopment of consciousness has been annihilated, then he becomes free of all fear, beyond the reach of change. This is the release potential within us all, and which anyone can attain through herohood. For as we read, all things are Buddha things. Or again, and this is the other way of making the same statement, all beings are without self.
Hinayana or Theravada Buddhism, the Buddhism surviving in Ceylon, Burma, and Thailand, reveres the Buddha as a human hero, a supreme saint and sage. Mahayana Buddhism, on the other hand, the Buddhism of the North, regards the Enlightened One as a world savior, an incarnation of the universal principle of enlightenment. A bodhisattva is a personage on the point of Buddhahood, according to the Hinayana view, an adept who will become a Buddha in a subsequent reincarnation. According to the Mahayana view, as the following paragraphs will show, a type of world savior representing particularly the universal principle of compassion. The word bodhisattva, Sanskrit, means whose being or essence is enlightenment. Mahayana Buddhism has developed a pantheon of many bodhisattvas and many past and future Buddhas. These all inflect the manifested powers of the transcendent one and only Adi Buddha, primal Buddha, who is the highest conceivable source and ultimate boundary of all being, suspended in the void of non-being like a wonderful bubble.
The world is filled and illumined by, but does not hold, the Bodhisattva, he whose being is enlightenment. Rather, it is he who holds the world, the lotus. Pain and pleasure do not enclose him. He encloses them, and with profound repose. And since he is what all of us may be, his presence, his image, the mere naming of him helps.
He wears a garland of 8,000 rays, in which is seen fully reflected a state of perfect beauty. The color of his body is purple gold. His palms have the mixed color of 500 lotuses, while each fingertip has 84,000 signet marks, and each mark 84,000 colors. Each color has 84,000 rays which are soft and mild, and shine over all things that exist. With these jewel hands, he draws and embraces all beings. The halo surrounding his head is studded with 500 Buddhas, miraculously transformed, each attended by 500 bodhisattvas, who are attended in turn by numberless gods. And when he puts his feet down to the ground, the flowers of diamonds and jewels that are scattered cover everything in all directions. The color of his face is gold, while in his towering crown of gems stands a Buddha, 250 miles high.
In China and Japan, this sublimely gentle bodhisattva is represented not only in male form, but also as female. Kuan Yin of China, Kuanan of Japan, the Madonna of the Far East, is precisely this benevolent regarder of the world. She will be found in every Buddhist temple of the farthest Orient. She is blessed alike to the simple and to the wise. For behind her vow, there lies a profound intuition, world-redeeming, world-sustaining. The pause on the threshold of nirvana, the resolution to forego until the end of time, which never ends, immersion in the untroubled pool of eternity, represents a realization that the distinction between eternity and time is only apparent, made perforce by the rational mind, but dissolved in the perfect knowledge of the mind that has transcended the pairs of opposites. What is understood is that time and eternity are two aspects of the same experience whole, two planes of the same non-dual ineffable, i.e., the jewel of eternity is in the lotus of birth and death. Om Mani Padme Hum. The first wonder to be noted here is the androgynous character of the bodhisattva. Masculine, Avalokiteshvara, feminine, Kuan Yin. Male-female gods are not uncommon in the world of myth. They emerge always with a certain mystery, for they conduct the mind beyond objective experience into a symbolic realm where duality is left behind. Awanawilona, chief god of the Pueblo of Zuni, the maker and container of all, is sometimes spoken of as he, but is actually he-she. The great original of the Chinese chronicles, the holy woman Tai Yuan, combined in her person the masculine yang and the feminine yin.
Yang, the light, active, masculine principle, and yin, the dark, passive, and feminine, in their interaction, underlie and constitute the whole world of forms, the 10,000 things. They proceed from and together make manifest Tao, the source and law of being. Tao means road or way. Tao is the way or course of nature, destiny, cosmic order, the absolute made manifest. Tao is therefore also truth, right conduct. Yang and Yin together as Tao are depicted in the Taijito symbol. Tao underlies the cosmos. Tao inhabits every created thing.
The The Kabbalistic teachings of the medieval Jews, as well as the Gnostic Christian writings of the second century, represent the Word made flesh as androgynous, which was indeed the state of Adam as he was created before the female aspect, Eve, was removed into another form. And among the Greeks, not only Hermaphrodite, the child of Hermes and Aphrodite, but Eros too, the divinity of love, the first of the gods, according to Plato, were in sex both female and male. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. The question may arise in the mind as to the nature of the image of God. But the answer is already given in the text and is clear enough. When the Holy One, blessed be he, created the first man, he created him androgynous. The removal of the feminine into another form symbolizes the beginning of the fall from perfection into duality, and it was naturally followed by the discovery of the duality of good and evil, exile from the garden where God walks on earth, and thereupon the building of the wall of paradise, constituted of the coincidence of opposites, by which man, now man and woman, is cut off from not only the vision, but even the recollection of the image of God. This is the biblical version of a myth known to many lands. It represents one of the basic ways of symbolizing the mystery of creation, the devolvement of eternity into time, the breaking of the one into the two, and then the many, as well as the generation of new life through the reconjunction of the two. This image stands at the beginning of the cosmogonic cycle, and with equal propriety at the conclusion of the hero task, at the moment when the wall of paradise is dissolved, the divine form found and recollected, and wisdom regained. Tiresias, the blinded seer, was both male and female. His eyes were closed to the broken forms of the light world of the pairs of opposites. Yet he saw in his own interior darkness the destiny of Oedipus. Shiva appears united in a single body with Shakti, his spouse, he the right side, she the left, in the manifestation known as Ardhanarishvara, the half-woman lord. The ancestral images of certain African and Melanesian tribes show on one being the breasts of the mother and the beard and penis of the father. And in Australia, about a year following the ordeal of the circumcision, the candidate for full manhood undergoes a second ritual operation, that of subincision, a slitting open of the underside of the penis to form a permanent cleft into the urethra. The opening is termed the penis womb. It is a symbolical male vagina. The hero has become, by virtue of the ceremonial, more than man. The blood for ceremonial painting and for gluing white birds down to the body is derived by the Australian fathers from their sub-incision holes. They break open again the old wounds and let it flow. It symbolizes at once the menstrual blood of the vagina and the semen of the male, as well as urine, water, and male milk. The flowing shows that the old men have the source of life and nourishment within themselves, i.e., that they and the inexhaustible world fountain are the same. The call of the great father snake was alarming to the child. The mother was protection, but the father came. He was the guide and initiator into the mysteries of the unknown. As the original intruder into the paradise of the infant with its mother, the father is the archetypal enemy. Hence, throughout life, all enemies are symbolical to the unconscious of the father. Whatever is killed becomes the father. Hence the veneration in head-hunting communities, in New Guinea, for example, of the heads brought home from vendetta raids. Hence, too, the irresistible compulsion to make war, the impulse to destroy the father, is continually transforming itself into public violence. The old men of the immediate community or race protect themselves from their growing sons by the psychological magic of their totem ceremonials. They enact the ogre father and then reveal themselves to be the feeding mother, too. A new and larger paradise is thus established. But this paradise does not include the traditional enemy tribes or races, against whom aggression is still systematically projected. All of the good father-mother content is saved for home, while the bad is flung abroad and about. For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And slacken not in following up the enemy. If ye are suffering hardships, they are suffering similar hardships, but ye have hope from Allah, while they have none. Totem, tribal, racial, and aggressively missionizing cults represent only partial solutions of the psychological problem of subduing hate by love. They only partially initiate. Ego is not annihilated in them. Rather, it is enlarged. Instead of thinking only of himself, the individual becomes dedicated to the whole of his society. The rest of the world, meanwhile, that is to say, by far the greater portion of mankind, is left outside the sphere of his sympathy and protection, because outside the sphere of the protection of his God. And there takes place, then, that dramatic divorce of the two principles of love and hate, which the pages of history so bountifully illustrate. Instead of clearing his own heart, the zealot tries to clear the world. The laws of the city of God are applied only to his in-group, tribe, church, nation, class, or what not, while the fire of a perpetual holy war is hurled, with good conscience and indeed a sense of pious service, against whatever uncircumcised, barbarian, heathen, native, or alien people happens to occupy the position of neighbor. The world is full of the resultant mutually contending bands, totem, flag, and party worshippers. Even the so-called Christian nations, which are supposed to be following a world redeemer, are better known to history for their colonial barbarity and internecine strife than for any practical display of that unconditioned love, synonymous with the effective conquest of ego, ego's world, and ego's tribal god, which was taught by their professed supreme lord.
I say unto you, love your enemies, do good to them which hate you, bless them that curse you, and pray for them which despitefully use you. And unto him that smiteth thee on the one cheek, offer also the other. And him that taketh away thy cloak, forbid not to take thy coat also. Give to every man that asketh of thee, and of him that taketh away thy goods, ask them not again. And as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. For if ye love them which love you, what thank have ye? For sinners also love those that love them. And if ye do good to them which do good to you, what thank have ye? For sinners also do even the same. And if ye tend to them of whom ye hope to receive, what thank have ye? For sinners also lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love ye your enemies, and do good, and lend, hoping for nothing again. And your reward shall be great, and ye shall be the children of the Highest. For he is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil. Be ye therefore merciful, as your Father also is merciful.
Compare the following Christian letter.
In the year of our Lord 1682, to ye aged and beloved Mr. John Higginson, there be now at sea a ship called Welcome, which has on board 100 or more of the heretics and malignants called Quakers, with W. Penn, who is the chief scamp, at the head of them. The General Court has accordingly given sacred orders to Master Malachy Huskett, of the Brig Porpoise, to waylay the said Welcome slyly, as near the Cape of Cod as may be, and make captive the said Penn and his ungodly crew, so that the Lord may be glorified and not mocked on